everybody in this room. I'm not going to call you by your names or by your organizations, but everybody is welcome. We have an agenda in front of us. I think we have apologies. Can we get the apologies first?
Thank you, Chair. The following apologies. Mr. Nkwankwa, due to illness, is unable to attend the meeting. And then also an apology from Mrs. Nopanda, who is the late Chair, but she will be joining us. Those are the apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much, and apologies accepted. Honourable members, today we are going to get our witnesses already here. He is going to give us evidence of corporate governance in Eskom, how Optimum coal mine was purchased. He's going to be a little bit detailed. I hope we are going to be as patient as possible so that we get what we want from him, what we invited him for. Today we are getting a presentation, therefore we are not going to be led by the evidence leader. We will just give over to give over to our witness and to present. Is the witness going to present? The witness is going to testify, and the evidence leader will lead him to testify. We are not going to have a certain time. We will give them enough time, the evidence to the evidence leader to lead the witness up to where he will indicate that he is finished. Hopefully we agree on that, members. Now I will go give over to the evidence list. Are you ready? Oh, he is going to speak under oath. The evidence that he is going to give here is going to give us under oath. I will therefore read the oath to him, and then he will then sign the oath after that. I just hope he's going to hear me clearly, because there is this noise that is happening, and I'm told it is sorted. I just hope that was the last chair that, or the last wheels that go that went on top of this roofing. Okay, fine. I'm speaking to you now. In accordance with Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and a Provincial Legislature Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath before a house or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17, Subsection 2 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who willfully furnishes a house or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You are required to take an oath that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. You may choose to take Okay, you said you are going to take an oath. Then this is the oath. I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Can you raise your right hand?
I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
Thank you very much. Then I will now give... Oh, you signed? Did you sign?
I've just signed it right now.
Okay. Then I will now give over to the evidence leader.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to yourself, the honourable members, and the guests of the committee. Mr. Marsden, for the record, can you just state your full names and provide the committee with your academic background and your working experience?
My name is Piers Michael Marsden. I am a chartered accountant with 15 years of experience working in the insolvency industry. I have a postgraduate qualification diploma in insolvency. I'm a registered senior business rescue practitioner at the CIPC, and I have done many business rescue assignments.
The committee has requested your assistance in relation to a transaction which was the purchase of Optimum Coal Holdings from Glencore by Tegeta. I would like to just ask you to explain to the committee what was your involvement with Optimum Coal Holdings, when that involvement started, when it ended, the capacity in which you were involved in, were you alone in the assignment that you were with? Also take that further to the one of the subsidiaries of Optimum Coal Holdings, which is Optimum Coal Mine, when you got involved with the mine and in which capacity you got involved, and whether or not you're still involved with that relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning, and to the Chair, honourable members and guests, thank you for your time. In answer to the question, this is a matter that really came to my attention a couple of weeks before the business rescue application was lodged, which dated with the 4th of August 2015. Myself and a colleague, Peter van den Steen, who has given me a letter of support and authority to appear here, and he is supportive of my actions and attendance here today, were effectively communicated by the board of Optimum Coal Holdings as well as Optimum Coal Mine, pursuant to a resolution passed on the 31st of July 2015, effectively where those two legal entities passed a resolution for the voluntary business rescue. I was formally appointed by the CIPC on the 4th of August 2015, at which point my involvement with the entities began. The business rescue process, and I'm not sure if anybody in the committee has any experience or requires me to go into any detail around any specifics of business rescue, but as a overriding process, it is designed to facilitate the rehabilitation of companies and essentially to place the management and operational control of those legal entities into the hand of an independent third party, in this example myself and Mr. van der Steen. Pursuant to our appointment, we understood and tried to gain a better understanding of the financial position as well as operational position of the various entities. From a structural point of view, and to the extent it's necessary, I do have an organogram which would assist the members to understand the legal process and where the items fit. But at a simplistic level, Optimum Coal Holdings is, as the name suggests, a holding company, and it had a number of different subsidiaries wholly owned, Optimum Coal Mine being the principal focus, but included within the other subsidiaries was Optimum Coal Terminal, which had the significant rail allocation through the Richards Bay Coal Terminal, the Quinfontein Mine, as well as a number of other subsidiaries which had various mining and prospecting rights. effective from my appointment, we understood very quickly that Eskom was going to be a fundamental player in the process. They were at the time the only customer for Optimum Coal Mine, which had a long-term coal supply agreement with Eskom, and as is much publicized, was a loss-making coal supply contract. There is an extensive history prior to my involvement, which I won't bore the committee with. It is detailed quite extensively in the Public Protector's Report, but it did involve a long-term supply agreement, a hardship, a cooperation agreement signed to try and find some level of agreement between the parties, and ultimately that sort of resulted in a situation where it had been approved at various levels within Eskom, but at the highest levels of Eskom, the agreement effectively failed. A penalty was applied on Optimum Coal Mine, and as a result of that, the company was financially distressed, and that was the reason why the Board of Directors applied for business rescue.
Sir?
Yes.
You speak about the penalty. Are you aware of the amount of the penalty and what the penalty was for?
Absolutely. The amount of the penalty, and really there are two components to the penalty. The first component, in the amount of about 2.1 billion rand, related to historic coal deliveries where product had been delivered to Eskom allegedly out of specification, and if my memory serves me correct, the specification was largely around the sizing of the product. The real concern, however, was the forward-looking review of the penalty, i.e., if the penalty were to be applied retrospectively, then looking forward, and if Eskom were taking the view that they were going to apply those principles, the mine would be even further loss-making, given that it would effectively not receive value for the product that it had delivered. So understanding that Eskom was a critical part of any plan to resuscitate the business, for the period of the next effectively 2 months, a variety of engagements were held, not only with Eskom, but with also other affected parties in the business rescue process. Those issues included discussions around the supply, the ongoing supply of product, various pre-litigation items, various proposals made by myself and my fellow practitioner with regards to the supply to Eskom going forward, discussions around the loss-making contract, and a variety of administrative actions effectively that we were doing as part of our business rescue process. Essentially, this was designed to ensure that we could avoid a liquidation. There were substantial numbers of people employed, principally at Optimum Coal Mine, but of course, if its holding company went into business rescue, which it had, it could also have an impact on the other subsidiaries, being Quinfontein, where there was significant employment. As a result of that, we had extensive negotiations with Eskom around proposals, around the supply, around proposals in terms of ongoing adjustments or amendments to the coal supply agreement. There was a termination of supply, which was then effectively resuscitated and supply continued by mutual agreement for the duration of the business rescue proceedings. That proceeded for the month of August, and essentially for the month of September as well, and we concluded an interim arrangement in the middle of September 2015, whereby the parties agreed to work together to try and find a solution to the onerous contract. In or around the 5th of October, it became apparent to us that a negotiated settlement around the coal agreement was unlikely to happen. In fact, we received written confirmation from Eskom that our proposals had been rejected in terms of restructuring the entity in its current format with its current shareholding. We then decided to pivot and effectively see if we could change the paradigm by introducing a potential purchaser for the mine. And on the 7th of October, on or about the 7th of October, we signed a binding term sheet with a third party. We had received numerous unsolicited requests to buy the mine, but we had at this point in time only just decided to move into the second phase. Prior to that, we were trying to negotiate a settlement, and included in those unsolicited offers was an advance made by KPMG on behalf of Tegeta. On the 7th of October, however, we decided to sign with a third party, which agreement effectively had as one of the heart and core parts of the agreement was that that third party needed to find some solution with Eskom to enable us to overcome the problem of the onerous supply agreement. Towards the middle and latter part of October, that transaction failed. We again implored Eskom to try and find a solution and to resolve the impasse, which would have seen not only the saving of several thousand jobs, but also the continued supply of product to Eskom.
Sorry, Mr. Mosden.
Yes, of course.
You're referring to a third party. You're referring to unsolicited proposals to purchase the mine that you turned down. Are you at liberty to share who these parties were that made these unsolicited proposals to you?
I'm pretty sure I'm not at liberty to, so I'm happy to disclose it. I think that the agreement that was signed, the term sheet that was signed, was with a company called Pembani. There were a variety of other unsolicited offers, none of which we had accepted. The only one we accepted was the Pembani offer, but the unsolicited offer did include entities like the state-owned mining company, as an example. Towards the latter half of October...
The Pembani supplier or proposal, which you'd signed the timesheet, why did it not proceed? Why did the transaction not proceed?
At the time, we were not given detailed reasons. Further on in the process, we received a letter from Pembani confirming that they had not been able to get sufficient answers from Eskom in terms of a proposed transaction.
So as business rescue practitioners of Optimum Coal Holding and Optimum Coal Mine, you were prepared to sell the Optimum Coal Holding with its subsidiaries to Pembani, but that Eskom did not agree to the transaction. Do I hear that correctly?
Just one minor correction. At this point in time, we were very much in discussions around Optimum Coal Mine. Optimum Coal Holdings was in itself a holding company, and as such, did not have any liabilities other than the bank debt, which was stayed as a result of the moratorium. So at this point in time, it was very much a discussion around Optimum Coal Mine and the sale of that asset. But other than that, you're correct. We had signed a term sheet to sell Optimum Coal Mine, subject to, of course, the usual commercial agreements, to Pembani.
And was there any specific reason that Eskom gave to you as to why it would not agree to the sale of Optimum Coal Mine to Pembani?
No, I was given no reason.
In your interactions with Pembani, were they given any specific reasons by Eskom as to why they wouldn't agree to the sale of the mine, Optimum Coal Mine, to Pembani?
I was not privy to the discussions between Eskom and Pembani, so unfortunately I'm not qualified or able to answer that.
I thought you said you had received confirmation from Pembani that Eskom did not agree to the sale of the mine, or did I misunderstand you?
No, you're correct. I had received a letter, as I said, not at this point in time from a chronological point of view, But later, once we had concluded a transaction with Tegeta, we did receive a letter from Pembani effectively suggesting that they perhaps had not been given an opportunity to do a similar type of transaction. But they did not detail any of their discussions with Eskom. So towards the latter part of October 2015, we once again implored Eskom to reconsider, given the potential liquidation that would have had disastrous impacts on employment as well as their ongoing supply. And with various correspondence, essentially we realized that we had better engage with further parties, and essentially we were left with Tegeta as the remaining offeror for the assets. They requested us to facilitate a meeting between themselves, that is Tegeta, and Eskom to see if a deal could be crafted, and at a meeting on the 24th of November, chaired by Eskom, effectively Eskom's position was laid out pretty clearly in terms of what a transaction could look like that they would be supportive of. That essentially involved a transaction not only of Optimum Coal Mine, but effectively the transaction that was ultimately concluded, which is a transaction that included both Optimum Coal Mine as well as the profitable Quinfontein Mine and the profitable Optimum Coal Terminal. And on that basis, Eskom was prepared effectively to look at a transaction. So effectively moving our gaze from being focused exclusively at Optimum Coal Mine to a much higher gaze, effectively involving the sale of Optimum Coal Holdings' entire set of subsidiaries, including Optimum Coal Terminal, as well as Quinfontein Mine. The rationale for that being that effectively there was a profitable side of the business and a loss-making side of the business, and Eskom's view, quite correctly I think, was that the one business needed to support the other business, and they did have a guarantee effectively from Optimum Coal Holdings. So they believed that the business would only be sustainable if it included both the good and bad sides of the business. That effectively kicked off a number of discussions with Tegeta, in terms of which we had received, as I mentioned, that meeting was on the 24th of the 11th. We received a verbal offer to the tune of R1 billion from the Tegeta Consortium. We had a meeting with the banking consortium, who had security over the assets and who would be another important party in making sure that the business rescue process was concluded. This would have seen them taking a substantial write-off on their debt, and as a result, they rejected the original offer on or around the 26th of the 11th. Following a number of discussions, effectively late in November, perhaps on the 1st of December, Glencore decided that they would rather support Optimum and discharge the business rescue. A meeting was held at Eskom at which this decision was made, subject to, of course, being able to restructure the bank debt to the tune of about R2.5 billion, and a meeting was then subsequently held in early December with the bank to let them know this fortuitous piece of news and the fact that ultimately it would resolve a restructure of their debt, but Glencore supporting the business going forward. Then in early, on the 4th or 5th of December 2015, we received an amended offer from the Tegeta Consortium, which effectively was the deal that was ultimately concluded. That deal was concluded on the 10th of December 2015. It includes a substantially increased purchase price, and it had an effective date of 1 January, but with four conditions precedent to the transaction, which needed to be met by the 31st of March 2016. One of those conditions precedent was the Competitions Tribunal giving their consent to the transaction, which was handed down on the 22nd of February. The second was a letter of comfort or a guarantee from the purchaser, effectively demonstrating their ability to deliver on their purchase price. In that regard, we received a letter on the 4th of March 2016, which is one of the specific items requested and is included in your packs. Sorry, just to highlight, the sale agreement is also in your pack as specifically requested. So that dealt with, although not entirely to the satisfaction of the banking consortium, but that effectively saw that condition precedent waived. And then on the 30th of March, we received the last two, which was Eskom's release letter and consent to the transaction, as well as the Section 11 consent from the Department of Mineral Resources. Thereafter, the business rescue plan was published. It was published on the 31st of March, and a meeting was held on the 8th of April 2016 to approve the plan, which subsequently happened, and the plan was approved. Essentially, what this meant was that the purchaser had 4 days in which to deliver the funds, and the seller had the same amount of period to effectively deliver the shares and to deliver the change of directors resolutions, the administrative documents, effectively to an escrow agent to enable the transaction to close. That was on the 8th of April. On the 11th of April, and I don't know if I can just briefly touch this because I'm sure this is going to be the subject of much questions, but on the 11th of April is effectively the subject matter of the Section 34 that we have effectively lodged. So I'm going to maybe skip over that and we can come back to that in perhaps more detail. So the 11th of April we had a variety of meetings, but ultimately on the 14th of April the transaction closed and Tegeta became the new shareholder of Optimum Coal Mine, Quinfontein, as well as Optimum Coal Terminal. At that point in time, Optimum Coal Holdings, having divested itself of all of its assets, effectively was discharged from business rescue. However, Optimum Coal Mine, still in business rescue, continued to trade as such until the 31st of August, when we discharged it from business rescue as a result of it no longer being financially distressed. That is effectively the end of my involvement with Optimum, the 31st of August, 2016.
31st August, 2016 or 2017? Can we then get back to the 11th of April, 2016? There were developments on the day. Can you just take the committee through those developments?
If the evidence leader doesn't mind, if I could maybe direct, it's probably easier for me to read directly from the statement in terms of the statement that was issued to the Director of Priority Crime Investigations. It'll, I think, perhaps help me form my words a little bit better. That is in the pack that was specifically requested. I've given quite a bit of the background.
Sorry, Mr. Marsden. In our packs, advocate, the information is not numbered. There are dividers in between, but the information is not numbered. Can you, advocate or Mr. Marsden, give us the top part of that document that he's going to read out of, so that we all go to that document. Thank you.
Absolutely. So it is the, in my folder, the blue one. I'm not sure if it's the same in yours, but essentially it has the SAPS logo at the start.
Yeah, Chair, I did inspect the annexures, and one of the documents that is missing is the Section 34 statement, which I have asked the committee secretary to just make a copy for the committee members, because I don't know whether it was because of haste or what. No, it is. It is here. It is under the pink file. But on top, you'll see there's a copy of the South African Police logo. Yes, under the South African Police logo there, you'll see. I have no
In our packs, it is there, but it's not in the same. Maybe the color of the divider would not be the same. Yeah, for all the packs.
Okay.
I saw it.
It's a green divider.
The others are not green. I said the colors of the divider will not be the same because mine is yellow and Mondli's is green. Yours might be pink, so, and the others might be blue.
I think the
easiest way is to say that the divider is number 5. It's divider number 5 in our packs.
What I like about it, it's non-racial. It's many colors.
It's not 5 to you, PG, it's 6. Okay.
May I proceed, Chair?
You can proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your help, advocate.
So if I could ask you to page through effectively the first couple of pages, which simply are administrative, and get to the page effectively titled Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation, Anti-Corruption Desk. Points 1, effectively through 9, are covered in terms of the background that I've given. So I'm going to pick up from point number 10, which is the sale agreement was subject to the fulfillment of certain suspensive conditions. These suspensive conditions were fulfilled and or waived on the 8th of April, thereby rendering the sale agreement unconditional. The purchase price was required to be paid by Tegeta to the attorneys as escrow agent on the third business day after the date in which the sale agreement became unconditional. The 8th was a Friday, so effectively taking us to the 13th of April. I received a phone call from Mr. Hauer of Tegeta on the 11th of April 2016, effectively 2 days before payment was due under the sale agreement, requesting a meeting at the offices of Tegeta in Sandton on such date. That meeting was held on that date at approximately 10 in the morning. At such meeting, I was advised by Hauer that Tegeta was 600 million rand short in respect of the purchase price, and he requested myself to approach the bank consortium to request a bridging loan in the amount of 600 million rand to finance the shortfall on the purchase price. The purchase price was in the amount of about 2.15 billion that was required effectively from the purchaser. At 1:30 on the 11th of April, I arranged a meeting with the consortium of banks. The meeting was attended by representatives of the consortium of banks as well as Glencore, at which meeting the consortium of banks requested me to advise Mr. Hauer that the banks were not prepared to finance the shortfall of the purchase price. I took this message effectively back to Mr. Hauer after deliberation. It was at approximately 3 o'clock on the 11th of April. And as I mentioned earlier, on the 14th of April, the amounts were paid and the purchase price had been discharged. The deal therefore closed. On the 12th of June 2016 and the 19th of June 2016, Carte Blanche aired a feature on this transaction, which precipitated the release of various press articles. A full-length interview with Hauer was also made available on the Carte Blanche website on the 20th of June. We reviewed the episode and the interview in the week of 20th of June, and we reviewed the articles. Pursuant to the episode, interview, and articles, we learned for the first time that Eskom had made a prepayment to Tegeta for the purchase of coal from Tegeta in an amount of 586 million rand. The coal for which the prepayment was made by Eskom appears to have been or is to be procured from Optimum Coal Mine for Tegeta and delivered by Optimum to Eskom's Arnett Power Station. We have come to learn from the episodes that the prepayment was approved by a committee of Eskom representative at a meeting at 9 o'clock in the evening on the 11th of April 2016. This meeting was held on the same day in which the request for the bridging finance of 600 million rand was made to and rejected by the consortium of banks. Pursuant to the interview, Howard remarked that the prepayment has been made on the basis that OCM was in business rescue and required money for its liquidity and for the start-up of equipment. We confirmed that the prepayment was not made to OCM and that OCM provides a 30-day payment term to Tegeta for the delivery of coal. We are mindful of Section 34(1) and our obligation to report any suspicious activity. We do not intend to draw any conclusions from the aforesaid, but wish to draw the attention of the Hawks to the circumstances of which we are aware as a matter of caution. We reserve our rights to provide supplementary documents, and the content of this letter is private and confidential.
You then wrote to the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigations. Actually, this letter that you just read was addressed to them. I see it's signed by your core business rescue practitioners, correct?
Signed by both of us, correct, yes.
You, page 3, paragraph 23, you're saying you're reporting what you perceive to be a suspicious activity. What was the basis of your suspicion?
I think everything has timing and context. Mindful of our meeting that had happened prior to the discharge of the purchase price, on the 11th of April, we were led to believe by Tegeta that they were 600 million rand short on the purchase price that they needed in order to close the transaction. And the timing of the prepayment was on the very same day, in fact at 9 o'clock in the evening, for an amount relatively similar. So the amount was for 586 million as far as I can remember. And so we believed that the timing of that was something that required further investigation. So both the quantum and the timing required further investigation.
Perhaps it would be an opportune at this stage just to indicate to the committee, who are the shareholders of Tegeta?
There is a detail effectively included in both the competitions filing as well as in the public protector's report. So please don't hold me if I'm a couple of percentage points off. But certainly Oak Bay and the Duduzam Nazuma's company, I think it's called Mabalangala, are the majority shareholders. But if you give me a couple of minutes, I'll be able to find who the detailed shareholders are. This is on page 112 of the Public Protector's Report, but effectively the percentage shareholding of Tegeta is Oak Bay 29.05%, Mabalangala 28.53%, Fidelity 12.91%, Accurate 8.01%, and Algasolve 21.5%.
Just on that page, who owns Oak Bay?
I obviously have no personal knowledge of who owns it, but clearly it is the investment arm of the Gupta family.
The 586 million rands, which you refer to on page 2, of your letter to the DPCI, paragraph 19.1. as a prepayment to Tegeta. Read that with paragraph 21 of the same letter on page 2, where you're referring to the remarks made by Mr. Hoa. In light of the two, in whose account would the 586 million have had to be paid to?
So we had no knowledge of the 586 million rand. We were not in control, certainly, of Tegeta. However, as mentioned, post the close of the deal, Optimum Coal Mine remained in business rescue from April until the 31st of August 2016. As a result, we were certainly in control of that legal entity, and Optimum Coal Mine did not receive the 586 million rand. Subsequent to the close of the transaction, Optimum Coal Mine entered into a sale agreement with Tegeta for the supply of coal to the Arnott Colliery. But at the time of the prepayment, certainly that payment was not made to Optimum Coal Mine. And in fact, on the date that the payment was made, if the public protector's numbers are correct, the payment was made to Tegeta, which was not the shareholder of the mine at the time either. It merely had a right to acquire the mine.
In your view, as the business rescue practitioner of Optimum Coal Mine, where should the 586 million should have been deposited? Into whose account should that money have been deposited?
I think, first of all, the rationale for the money would need to be interrogated in the first place. Optimum Coal Mine was in business rescue, so clearly was financially distressed. We had, however, negotiated better payment terms on the Hendrina contract. This coal supply agreement was between Tegeta and between Eskom. It was not between Optimum and Tegeta. It was, of course, back-to-back, subsequent to the prepayment, in terms of an agreement between Optimum and Tegeta. So in terms of a very Optimum Coal Mine point of view, we never supplied the coal to Eskom. We supplied the coal to Tegeta on 30-day payment terms. So the prepayment was a transaction between Tegeta and between Eskom. And the issue that we had, or we took with regards to the various interviews, was that the rationale given for the prepayment was twofold. First of all, that the company was in business rescue. As I've mentioned, we didn't get that. Second of all, that equipment was required in order to mobilize and increase production. We were currently in control of that mine, and whilst there was a modest amount that was required in order to restart a second drag line, it certainly wasn't anywhere near the quantum of 586 million rand. I hope that's answered your question.
You're probably not aware, I am aware. That there was a 1.6 billion guarantee from Eskom, which assisted in the facilitation of the payment of the purchase price. Are you aware of that amount of money?
Just from the press.
So in terms of the payment of this particular transaction, you as business rescue practitioners, and I've had a look at the contract relating to this purchase of shares and rights, you are one of the parties to this agreement. From the explanation, it would appear that you were in the dark as to the source of funding for this transaction. Is that correct?
The ultimate source is incorrect. When we concluded the transactions, one of the conditions precedent was that the purchaser demonstrate to us that they had the financial ability to conclude this transaction. We were effectively given a letter of comfort from their bankers that they did have the funds available in order to conclude this transaction. So we relied on that letter in terms of concluding a transaction. The ultimate source of the funds that discharged the purchase price only became known to us and effectively predicated the Section 34 declaration.
Clearly, and this is very apparent from your statement to the DPCI, and I assume that it's a package that informs your suspicion around the activities on the 11th of September. That there is a meeting between yourself and Mr. Orr in the morning. In the afternoon around 3, you report back to him that the banks whom you had approached have conceded his request unfavorably. And midnight on the same evening, there is a board tender committee meeting which you had at the time no knowledge of. Not surprising, because you are not a board member of ESCOM. At 9 o'clock, at night on the 11th, the BTC approves this 586 million rand. Now, those are the facts. What I'm interested in pursuing with you is the following. Mr. Owa was not a board member at ESCOM. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so.
The purchasers were not and still are not directors or board members of the ESCOM board.
As far as I understand, that's correct.
That the meeting gets to be convened by whoever, and surely that meeting must have been convened by members of the board or relevant members of the board tender committee. And that board committee then deals with the prepayment, which later forms part of paying the purchase price. If I were to put it to you then, and I would like your comment on this hypothesis, that Mr. Rowa must have control over the people that convened that board tender committee that evening of the 11th of April 2016. What would be your response to that?
I think that the timing and the quantum certainly look suspicious, but the hypothesis is something I think above my pay grade in terms of whether they have control. We certainly raised the issue. It certainly doesn't look fantastic. I think if you look at it in the context of the Public Protector's report, particularly the communication between Mrs. Raghavan and Mr. Molefe at that point in time, there is certainly something that requires further investigation.
Maybe the word hypothesis scares you. Maybe let's use common sense. There must have been a relationship which you and I seated here, now and here, cannot explain. But this relationship from the purchasers, because surely if they are to get 586 million from Eskom, you see, if the banks that you had approached were to give Mr. Hawa the 600 million, it would have been because you were approached, you went to the bank, and the banks would have agreed to loan the 600 million. Is that correct?
Certainly that was the request that was made of me.
Now, you and I seated here might not know the role players, but it would appear that somebody must have initiated this special odd meeting on the same day, that evening, for that meeting to take place.
I would imagine that meetings like that do require notice, and certainly the commendable work ethic to meet in the evening, but I have no knowledge around what required timeframes, notices, Eskom's internal meetings have. It may have been called earlier, or I have no knowledge of that.
But we know, I know, and let me not say we know, let me say, I know that before your meeting and your response to Mr. Hawa on the 11th of April 2016, there was no special board tender committee convened. Not certainly to look at the prepayment of the amount you've requested or you've stated in a statement. So that you can accept from me. So I'm saying, if the 586 million paid the purchase price, those in need of the 586 million would have had to approach Eskom in one way or the other for them to get the 586 million. In the same manner in which you were requested to approach the banks.
That appears to be correct. I think that the convening of the meeting I have no knowledge of, so to the extent I'll rely on your statement. It does seem an extraordinary large amount of money to not only approve but to pay down within a relatively short amount of time.
And at this stage, you and I might not know who approached who, but we know that somebody convened this meeting, and the sole issue on the agenda was this particular matter. So, it's an issue how the meeting was convened and what was to be discussed and all those things. I'm not going to bother you with those. ESCOM board, particularly the board tenure committee members, will have to deal with those. But what I'm interested in, just using common sense, the meeting then gets to be convened, and we know now the money was paid, contributed to the purchase price. Would you then say, directly or indirectly, ESCOM contributed to the purchase price for the purchase of the mine?
Certainly that's the conclusion that the former public protector reached, and it seems pretty unequivocal in terms of the flow of funds as detailed in her report.
You reported to the police. I'm just looking at the date. That's what I'm trying to find. When was this reported to the police?
The 1st of July, 2016.
It's now over a year, 3 months. Have you heard anything from the Directorate for Prior to Crime Investigation regarding this matter?
I thought you might ask that. We received an acknowledgement of receipt immediately on the 1st of July as we reported it. Immediately as we reported, so 2016, we received an acknowledgement that it had been received. In May, between the 18th and 23rd of 2017, I was contacted by a warrant officer for further particulars, which culminated in a 34-3 affidavit that I signed, almost identical to the one that you're looking here. Yes, in May of 2017, between the 18th and the 23rd, those interactions culminated in me signing a further 34-3 affidavit in July 2017, with a warrant officer, and then as recently as Thursday of this week, I received a further email from what appears to be the new investigator requesting a further interview, and I've been here, but I hope to see him in the next couple of days.
So the first meeting was to record your letter in a different format, in the form of an affidavit. Do I understand you correctly?
That's correct.
And that was just over 8-9 months after you had lodged your letter.
Correct. So the discussions commenced. My earliest record is the 18th of the 5th, 2017. There were a variety of documents that we required to ensure that we were dealing with the correct parties. And ultimately, there was a meeting held and a further affidavit signed in July 2017. The original application, 1st of July 2016.
Given the developments around the 11th, and looking at the shareholders of the purchasers, do you have any reason to believe that the prepayment of 580-something million had anything to do with who owned the purchaser.
I've got no knowledge of that. I wouldn't be able to comment.
So your only concern about the transaction are the events on the 11th of April, 2016, which you became aware of much later.
I think that is the principal item that we were concerned around. Throughout the transaction, we encountered a particularly acrimonious relationship that we effectively inherited when we started Business Rescue with regards to Eskom, and it was quite difficult to engage with them on a meaningful basis in terms of trying to find a solution for the business rescue of both the coal mine and coal holdings. This could have been ascribed to playing hardball. This could have been ascribed to many commercial rationale, but it certainly was not an easy transaction. We had formidable players in the game, both from Eskom, the DMR, and Glencore, so it was a particularly difficult transaction.
Let's go back to the 2.0 billion fine. What? Where did that... What happened to the fine? At the time that you were business rescue practitioners, and at the time of the sale, and according to your knowledge, at the time that you closed the business rescue practice.
So the fine was one of the principal reasons for the company entering into business rescue. For both Optimum Coal Mine, which was effectively had the long-term supply contract, but Optimum Coal Holdings had also signed a guarantee for the obligations of Optimum Coal Mine, hence the reason for Optimum Coal Holdings going into business rescue as well. One of the advantages of business rescue is it effectively puts a stay on legal proceedings. And the view that we took throughout the business rescue process was to effectively use that shield of the business rescue process to avoid having to litigate on that particular matter. I think that the fine itself is an item that was subject to much technical dispute and would have required extensive arbitration, not only from a legal point of view, but also from a technical point of view to determine the veracity and or the quantum of the claim. In terms of the purchase, that liability remained with the legal entity. So Optimum Coal Mine as a legal entity itself was acquired by Tegeta, and effectively that issue was kicked down the road post the end of the business rescue. So throughout the business rescue process, we effectively used the stay on legal proceedings to not deal with it in terms of arbitration and or litigation.
Before you decided to sell the mine and later the holding company with all its subsidiaries, this issue of the fine, which had brought the company into the situation that it found itself, which, as you have reflected, was subject of a lot of technical discussion, negotiations between the shareholder, which then you came into the picture with Eskom. What was the attitude of Eskom towards the fine?
Throughout the process, Eskom's attitude, and I think it's important once again to reiterate, the component of the fine is twofold. The 2.1 relates to the historic coal that had been used. perhaps more relevant is looking forward, and that if Eskom were to apply the strict criteria going forward, you would, for the remainder of the contract, you would have a quantum far in excess of the 2 billion as well. So it was a fundamental issue, and certainly each purchaser, and if we go back to some of the items we've covered already, the fundamental issue was that there needed to be satisfactory resolution not only to the 2.1 billion fine, but also in terms of the contract going forward and the couple of billion rand that could ultimately come out of that. Eskom's position, I think, has been laid quite clearly down in the press, as well as in various correspondence that we have, in that their expectation was that the fine needed to be settled, and they were pretty unequivocal around that.
Surely you must have engaged with the shareholder, that is Glencore, when you took over, particularly around the issue of the fine, because that brought a lot of burden and strain on the business. What was the attitude on the fine?
I think the fine itself is an item that could have been arbitrated on. I think that there were many legal protections included in the agreement, and those mechanisms had been applied prior to the business rescue. The hardship clause, the agreement, the cooperation agreement signed between Optimum and Eskom prior to the business rescue. And ultimately, their view on the fine was that it's a bit like going to a restaurant and eating a steak, and when you finished it, asking if you don't have to pay for it because you didn't like it. You know, there's a certain view around the fact that the product was actually utilized. I think if product's out of specification, you say take your product back rather than consume it. So the issue around the fine, and certainly Glencore would have had the stomach to continue to fight that and arbitrate on it, the real issue is around the ongoing obligations. If the attitude persisted around insisting on those particular items, there would be very little liquidity in the business because effectively your customer wouldn't be paying for the product supplied. So that is perhaps the more relevant component of the fine. With regards to the attitude, I always believed that the former shareholders believed that the fine itself could be argued, and there may be a component of it that was valid, but the vast majority of it could probably, in an arbitration, be resolved.
And that position was put to Eskom, and that notwithstanding, Eskom was adamant that the fine, the historical fine, had to be settled.
Eskom wished to arbitrate in the business rescue process. We believe that we certainly didn't have the liquidity to mount a substantial arbitration, so we used effectively the business rescue to not get into the matter. But of course, we did have discussions with Eskom around the resolution of the fine, and as stated many times in the press as well as in various correspondence that we have, they remained adamant that that fine should be paid in totality.
What would you then be your take? And because there will be evidence led before the committee at some stage and you would not be around, and I would like to afford you an opportunity to comment on that state of affairs, particularly with the knowledge that you possess around the negotiations on the fine. That subsequent to the sale, the successful sale of the mine and the holding company with the other subsidiaries, that fine in excess of 2 billion rands, which Eskom was at amount that it had to be paid, that fine had been reduced to less than 600 million. What will be your take on that?
I think really two aspects to my response. First of all, I think the speed at which it was resolved was a surprise. We believed that it would involve extensive arbitration, argument, counter-argument, technical evaluation, legal argument. So that's the first comment. The second comment is that I think we always believed that there was an element of the fine that in detailed legal and technical discussion would be overturned. So that's really my only comments on it.
Earlier on you testified that what was to be sold was Optimum Coal Mine. And later on, Eskom insisted on the sale of the entire, of the holding company together with its subsidiaries. And you then said, at the time it made sense to you. Does it make sense to date?
Just to maybe rehash why I thought it made sense to me, I think that the other mine within the group, Kwinfontein, was reliant on Eskom to be a customer for the Komati power station. And it would seem unusual for Eskom to suffer a loss on the one hand and contribute on the other. So certainly our view, given that Eskom had the holding company guarantee, was that that made prudent financial sense from Eskom's perspective to ensure that their in-the-money contract balanced their out-the-money contract. So certainly that made a lot of sense. And from an OCT perspective, the rail allocation is clearly a valuable asset. In terms of where it currently sits, and once again I lose all visibility on the 31st of August, so I have no personal knowledge of the current state of affairs, but it certainly does appear as if the other parts of the group have either been sold or are in the process of being sold. I can't comment whether those deals have concluded or not, but that kind of goes in the face of the rationale in terms of which those profitable assets are needed to support Optimum Coal Mine to fulfill its obligations till the end of December 2018 in terms of the loss-making agreement.
So effectively, if the Richards Bay is the mine that is the, or the subsidiary that the Richards Bay subsidiary of the Optimum Coal Holding, which is making money, which makes sense for Eskom to say, we need to balance, we need to get both the money making and where we're bleeding. If the Richards Bay component is sold, what would be the effect of that selling be on Eskom's financial position vis-a-vis the situation where that the Richards Bay subsidiary is part and parcel of this holding company?
So Eskom has a guarantee effectively from Tegeta, which replaced OCH in the structure. I think post December 2018, if Optimum Coal Mine had delivered in 100% compliance with the agreement, there would be no financial effect. If it were to be sold prior to that, and those funds were then allowed to be discharged to shareholders or whomever, and as a result of that, Optimum was not able to deliver, Eskom would not have the ability to look towards the profitable assets for the performance of the shareholder for its subsidiary. So it's all around timing. To the extent that those assets are disposed of and Eskom does not act on its guarantee for the obligations of Optimum Coal Mine, potentially it may be in a bad position, but this is all speculation.
No further questions, sir.
Thank you very much to the evidence leader and Mr. Marsden. My apologies for keep on forgetting the surname. Members, We are about to ask questions. But what I would want to get clarity on, Mr. Marsden, is the meeting of the 11th of April. In your statement, you are saying that meeting was a meeting of representative of ESCOM. You are not specific in saying ESCOM board, the executive of ESCOM. You are saying it's a representative. Is it possible that those representatives are people that had an interest in the transaction, or people who would not even know what the transaction was about? Can I just get clarity on that?
Thank you, Chair. The meetings that I attended on the 11th was with Mr. Hawa at Tegeta and a follow-on meeting with the banking consortium. I was not present, nor do I know who attended the ESCOM, or for that matter what type of committee it is at ESCOM. So unfortunately, I have zero knowledge about who attended that, what a quorum was, whether they voted in favour. I've simply got no knowledge on that.
But you know there was a meeting in the evening of that day?
I became aware of it as a result of the carte blanche show.
Members, I wanted to ask questions first before you come, because sometimes you're not giving me a chance to ask questions. Just give me, I've got only two that I think, and a comment that I think would be fair. Mr. Hawa remarked on OCM rescue, according to your statement. Does this mean the banks did not give the guarantee, did not give the money, or did not agree on rescuing OCM? But ESCOM was of the opinion, or was adamant in saying, OCM, regardless of what is happening, needs to be rescued. And ESCOM would even go beyond their principles and their policies and just pay OCM so that it gets rescued at that moment.
I certainly can't speak on behalf of the banks. There were three of them. I think that their view was merely there as lenders. They had a substantial debt obligation owed of about 2.5 billion rand. It is certainly not their obligation to rescue the business. That's my job. However, what it does require is their consent to any plan that has been proposed. So the plan that was ultimately proposed, which was the sale of the entities to Tegeta, they were in support of it, subject, of course, to receiving the proceeds. And those proceeds were scheduled to be 2.15 billion rand, not 2.15 billion rand, less 600 million rand. So clearly their view was that their support was contingent on receiving the full purchase price, hence their unwillingness to effectively bridge that shortfall. With regards to ESCOM, once again, I can't pretend to speak for ESCOM, but certainly one of the key considerations for ESCOM throughout this process was the continued supply of coal to the Hendrina power station. So the ability to have that supply guaranteed must certainly have factored into their thinking, amongst, I'm sure, many other factors.
Were you not suspicious when the investigating officer, after such a long time, now all of a sudden wants to meet you? Were you not suspicious what would happen? Because I'm asking this because this inquiry has been publicized, and there were the witnesses. Some of the witnesses were known by everybody outside there, that there are witnesses that are coming. even the witness that will come to give evidence on the issue of the optimum coal mine and the transactions thereof were also out there. They were known. Were you not suspicious of why would the officer now all of a sudden have an interest in responding to what you have long done, or what the charges that you've laid long ago? Were you not suspicious of that?
I think I was grateful to have somebody to engage with in terms of trying to move the ball forward. I have not yet met the individual. Obviously, I was preparing for this, but I hope to meet him in the next couple of days.
Okay, those were just my concerns that I wanted to raise. Member Natasha, Member Mondli, Member Moss, Member Swart, Member Member Madlamin, Member who? And Member Khaula, and Member Luyenge. I know his surname.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Morrison, my name is Natasha Mazzoni. Tegeta was a pretty unknown entity at the time that it entered into the bigger scheme of things. At the time, did you know that it was a Gupta-affiliated, and the fact that Duduzani Zuma was one of the shareholders of Tegeta Mine? When
yes.
did you become aware of that?
No, we knew from the start.
From the start. So in your business rescue practice, was this the first time you'd done a business rescue proposal for a mine, or had you done mines and coal mines and that kind of thing in the past?
I've done similar mining matters.
So did it come as a surprise to you, as it did to the rest of us, that Tegeta, this very unknown entity, suddenly became such a big role player?
I think certainly it was a concern we had, and certainly the way that the deal was structured involved ensuring that they had the financial ability to conclude on the transaction. So it was a concern of ours.
How did you know that they had the financial ability to conclude on the deal?
We received a letter, I think it is included in your pack, from a banking institution confirming that on closure of the transaction, the funds were available.
Now, obviously, you're a business rescue practitioner and you know your stuff. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So certainly it becomes extremely concerning when you find out that a company like Eskom, who's well known to be in a financial state of distress, institutes a prepaid amount, and not a small amount, a huge amount of money, that obviously, I mean, it's beyond dispute. It's obvious that it's been thrown in the mix to break up a deal that you've been busy brokering. What do you do at that point, and who do you turn to at that specific point?
So we became aware of that post the closing of the deal. So we turned to the DPCI in terms of this report.
In the negotiations, when the business rescue was brought to you, the amount of 2.15 billion is the penalty. Now, we've dealt with Eskom for long enough to know that Eskom does everything in its power not to enact penalty clauses against companies for some unknown reason. I find it very strange, and I want your opinion. Did you think it was strange that after such a long period of time of having accepted what they now say is substandard quality coal from Optimum, that all of a sudden this penalty clause was enacted?
I have no personal knowledge of what happened prior to business rescue, but clearly I have had sight of documents. And there appears to have been a long history to this in terms of a 25-year-long supply agreement. And it had built into it what you would expect in an agreement of that nature, with hardship clauses, and there was a substantial amount of effort that had gone in, Optimum under the control of its previous shareholders and Eskom, in terms of trying to find a solution to that particular issue that culminated essentially in a cooperation agreement being signed between the parties prior to business rescue, and I'm sure the evidence leader has the exact committees within ESCOM, but it certainly had a high degree of support within ESCOM prior to business rescue. Ultimately, those negotiations failed at a very senior level in ESCOM, and the penalty was then applied. So in terms of what happened, I simply have the documents to refer to. I can't pick up the atmosphere in meetings that I wasn't at, but certainly there appears to have been a breakdown in those negotiations that ultimately culminated in the business rescue.
Now, in terms of substandard coal, why would we want substandard coal? So why would it be in ESCOM's interest to ensure that this company is bought out and that the substandard coal continues to be supplied to ESCOM?
I think, to be fair to ESCOM, their view has always been that it needs to be within specification. So not only must it be delivered at the price, it must be delivered within specification. So I don't think it was ever their intention to state that we would accept substandard coal.
In the lead-up to in your dealings with putting together this business rescue, you say to us that you received unsolicited approaches. Is this normal that during a business rescue you receive unsolicited approaches to purchase a company?
Absolutely, it happens all the time.
So it does happen all the time. So it's normal. And in your unsolicited bids, did you have personal interaction with these companies? So in other words, I'm going to ask it quite bluntly, did the Guptas or Duduzani Zuma themselves ever approach you directly?
Not directly. They were working via their auditors at the time. But certainly we had unsolicited approaches from them, and I understand that approaches prior to business rescue were also made.
So just for clarity so that we have it on record, the name of the auditors?
KPMG.
KPMG. So KPMG were representing the Guptas and Duduzani Zuma, and they approached you for an unsolicited purchase of the mine.
That's correct.
Right, thank you. My last question, Chair. The acrimonious relationship that you said existed in ESCOM. Now, I can imagine that must be a terribly difficult position to find yourself in, because I think business rescue is hard enough as it is. Let's be honest, it's very difficult. You said it was a complicated issue that dated back a long time before you had arrived. You're trying to save a company. Why do you think that this acrimonious relationship existed? Because to me it sounds like it was a fabricated acrimonious relationship, because it suited certain individuals to have an acrimonious relationship.
I don't think I can comment on that. It was prior to there. When I got there, it was a relatively acrimonious relationship. I can't comment as to how that started or when it started or whether it was fabricated.
Can you tell me specifically between which parties this acrimonious relationship existed?
So I think between the senior executive of ESCOM and between the senior executive of the former shareholders of Optimum Glencore.
And just it's all in line with this question. Do you think that there was a deliberate attempt by ESCOM to ensure that the business rescue that you'd put on the table failed, so that Tegeta would be able to come in and purchase the mine?
I think that's a very difficult question. I think that certainly we ran out of options in terms of what is available within a business rescue. Generally, you try and restructure the affairs of the company and retain the structure as it is. As I detailed at the start, that process of about 2 months was challenging in terms of just trying to get constructive discussion going around restructuring it. The next phase was to try and approach buyers to see if you could change the paradigm and saying, well, if there is an unfair or an acrimonious relationship between the existing shareholders, if we change that dynamic, i.e. get a new shareholder, would that change the dynamic? And I think that we saw a number of suitors not able to come to terms with ESCOM, which left us effectively with one party.
Chair, my very last point on this. In this business rescue structure that you put forward, and with your knowledge of the South African financial laws, what laws, in your opinion, and this isn't your personal opinion, this is in your professional opinion, what laws do you think have been breached in the way the business rescue and the purchase of Tegeta, Optimum by Tegeta? What laws do you think have been breached or broken?
I'm a chartered accountant, so I'm certainly not a lawyer, so I do not believe I'm qualified to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Gungubel.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mazdi, for your availability. I think Ms. Honourable Mazwan has raised some issues that I wanted to raise, but there's one point I want to further follow. This question of the penalty quality of coal, and coal being supplied from the similar mine, if I'm correct to date, or post optimum target period. I'm not sure your answer is, because the question was, if we were penalized for the state of coal that you were presenting that time, your supply, what has changed in the current coal, in the coal post penalty that you are receiving? Can you make a point there?
So not all coal is created equal. I think that you are able to beneficiate coal, and once again, I'm not a technical person, but certainly in my limited knowledge, you are able to beneficiate coal to get it within specification, either by washing it or by handling it. One of the major components was the sizing issue. So certainly you are able to amend and change specifications. Throughout the period of the business rescue, we, as I mentioned previously, had an interim agreement with Eskom where they effectively gave us less stringent quality criteria for the period of the business rescue. Post the business rescue, I can't comment.
Less stringent as compared to the time the penalty was charged?
Yes, I think so.
What was the purpose of less stringent in this?
We entered into an interim agreement largely around to amend the payment terms. So we were traditionally paid on 30 days, but given in business rescue we needed a bit more liquidity, we amended that to 7 days. And they agreed, and I'll have to get the exact details of the wording of it, but agreed something to the tune of not enforcing penalties with regards to substandard coal. Of course, we tried to deliver coal within specification, and it really depends on the seam at that point in time.
Do you have a detailed knowledge of the specific deficit during the charging of penalty and compared to the time the requirements were less stringent?
Not on me, but I would have that information available.
Wait, did you have it?
Yes.
So, during your less stringent period, were you given quality then that was lesser than during penalty?
The issue relates primarily to the sizing of the coal. So the quality of the coal was of sufficient quality in terms of the calorific value, in terms of the ash and the moisture. It was really around a percentage of product that is sized differently. So the coal was of a good quality.
So Optimum had pre-stated specifics. And when the penalty was charged, does it mean they were not meeting those stated?
Certainly that was the allegation levied by Eskom in terms of that.
Own assessment, was that the situation?
I think it's not a static position. I think the quality of coal changes. So certainly there would have been periods where it would have not been within specification, but there would have been periods when it would have been within specification. It's really on a continuous basis sampled to ensure. It's not a simple question.
Okay, let's come to Pembani. You seem to have reached an agreement with Pembani to buy. What was the attitude of Eskom?
So we had signed certainly a term sheet. I was then not party to their discussions with Eskom, but it appears, and the communication that we got was that they were not able to come to terms with Eskom, and as a result, our transaction with them failed.
The first interface was between yourselves as rescuers with Pembani.
That's correct.
And you assessed Pembani.
That's correct.
And you thought that Pembani was competent to buy.
That's correct.
Was it not important to find out Eskom, why their position in spite of your assessment?
I think Eskom had made their position to us pretty clear in terms of the renegotiation of the contract and the payment of the penalties, and their position was that unless a party came to the table that would take the contract as it was, warts and all, and would commit to the penalty, they would not want to engage further. So we certainly did get Eskom's view on why that is. You'd have to ask Pembani in terms of why they withdrew, but I suspect it as a result of them not being able to meet those criteria.
In your view, do you think Eskom unfairly increased stringency of measures, or what exactly happened, knowing what Eskom told you?
I think they were applying what they believed to be their legal position. I can't comment as to whether that's common practice or not, but certainly they took a pretty hard-line attitude towards the enforcement of the agreement.
What was their attitude towards Tegeta?
I think their attitude was that on the basis that Tegeta could meet their requirements, they would be prepared to engage with them.
Requirements as stated with Pembani?
Requirements as stated in terms of the contract, yes.
I'm saying as stated with Pembani.
I'm not party to their conversations with Pembani, but the...
But they told you the reasons. If I heard you, you're saying Eskom told you the reason why they could not get into a deal with Pembani.
Eskom didn't. Pembani told us. Eskom had stated...
I thought you were saying Pembani did not share this with you, but Eskom told you.
So Eskom never spoke to us with specific reference to Pembani. They simply said any party that you bring in terms of a corporate transaction would need to meet these criteria.
The criteria?
They did indeed.
They did?
They did.
Is it the same criteria they gave to Tegeta?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Paragraph 6, what was the basis of that agreement?
Sorry, Honourable Member, in terms of
the statement. 10 December 2015. You are saying in your last sentence, the business rescue practitioners were party to these agreements. What was the basis of that agreement?
So the agreements are, once again, everybody's...
If I'm correct, we're dealing with Tegeta now.
Correct.
So in that paragraph.
That is correct.
What was the basis of that agreement? I'm asking this question because later there were problems.
Understood. So this is the agreement that effectively gives effect to the sale transaction. So this is an agreement that we've signed in our capacities as the business rescue practitioner of Optimum Coal Holdings, detailing the mechanisms for the sale of these businesses to Tegeta. So this is effectively the sale of share and claims agreement that is
selling
it to Tegeta. That's correct.
Am I correct to say you would have assessed the condition of all the parties, in particular the prospective purchaser in this instance? Were you happy with the situation of the prospective purchaser, which was?
I think what we catered for within that agreement is that any uncertainty that we had needed to be dealt with before that condition became...
What were the uncertainties here?
I think that we had dealt with, as I said, our constituents as a business rescue practitioner were all effectively conditions precedent to the agreement. So it required... Sorry, I just want to finish, and then you can do. The bank consortium were required to effectively approve of the transaction. Eskom were required to approve of the transaction. The Competitions Commission were required to approve of the transaction, and the Department of Mineral Resources were required. So we had done an element of due diligence, but before the transaction closed, it did require the sign-off of all of those parties.
Am I correct to say there must be a document detailing the sale of agreement and those, if I'm correct, those suspensive conditions? Do you have a document that details that?
The Honourable Member, it's in the pack as well, so I'm happy to go to that. Absolutely, it was one of the specific documents that we've... So once again, on Chair, the colours, I'm not sure where it is. It appears to be right at the back of my pack, so kind of the last one. It's got a worksman's attorney in the top right corner, and it is styled Sale of Shares and Claims Agreement. I think it's the last one, Honourable Member. So if I can take you to effectively paragraph number 3 of that agreement. Details the suspensive conditions that are required in order to take this to a final and binding agreement. If I can take you to the relevant ones.
Sorry, Mr. Marston, can you give him a chance to get to the agreement?
My apologies, Chair.
As you are
Chair.
Going through.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay.
It's page.
Okay.
It's page
16. Page 16 to everyone.
So I'm actually going to go to page 17 to highlight these particular issues. So in clause 3.1.3, the proposed transaction is approved by 3.1.3.1, the lenders and the security agent, 3.1.3.2, the competitions authority, 3.1.3.3, the Minister of Mineral Resources, and then 3.1.4 effectively deals with Eskom's consent.
Is there do you have the financial suspensive condition there?
So I will get it to you shortly. It's embedded in the 3.1.3.1, whereby the lenders, in order to give their consent to the transaction, remember ultimately they were going to be the recipient of the funds, required, in order to meet that condition, required a proof of funding. If I can just maybe then take you, and it explains why the letter is not addressed to myself, as the practitioner, also included in your pack, ultimately is that letter, and that's why it's addressed to the bank consortium as opposed to myself. It was required in order to meet that particular condition. So that is quite near the front. It's the second, or I think it's the third portion of your folder, and it's a letter from the Bank of Baroda, addressed to the banking consortium.
Go back then to Pembani. I want to ask you this question. Having been satisfied with the ability of Pembani, were there similar suspensive conditions? Was Pembani meeting all the requirements? To what degree were they meeting them as compared to Tegeta?
So a couple of points on that issue. We never got to the stage with Pembani of having a comprehensive legal agreement signed. We simply had a term sheet signed. And certainly the conditions that would have been included in the term sheet would have had very similar issues to these, in terms of particularly being able to deal with the consents required from Eskom in terms of 3.1.4. Another important consideration is that Pembani were at that point in time looking at OCM as opposed to at OCH. So there were differences between the transactions.
In your view as business, with the academic experience and practice that you have, what was more cost-effective for Eskom? Was it the rescue of Optimum or dealing with an alternative supplier?
I think you'd have to ask that question to Eskom, and I suppose it would be a little bit like gazing into a crystal ball, because there's a short-term cost, there's a medium-term cost, and there's a long-term cost, and the story is not fully played out yet. I think that the contract to supply Hendrina, which is the effectively the onerous contract, only expires at the end of December 2018. And I suppose we can only fully quantify which was the best alternative if and when that contract is completed in its entirety.
Last two questions is to deal actually in the prepayment, just for my clarity, who is the payer and who is the payer here?
From what I understand in the public protector's report, the payer was Eskom and the receiver or the payer, well, I'm getting my names wrong, Eskom paid it and Tegeta got it, not OCM.
Tegeta got it. You said at that time they were not owners of the company or the mining.
That's correct. If you know, going to that critical period around the 11th of April and the approval. And
do you remember at what point was ownership executed? Ownership transfer executed.
So the closing date of the transaction, I'm sure the evidence leader can correct me if I'm incorrect, but it was either the 14th or the 15th of April. So the last remaining...
So after the 586 million?
That is my understanding, correct.
Okay, let's come now to the... So my last question is, the police met, gave you, you received acknowledgement on the July 2016, and then affidavit May 2017, and then another affidavit, 2017 July. If you, using your own assessment, what was material distinctions between the requirement of May and that of July in 2017?
The affidavits that I signed in terms of the original application and the further affidavit in July 2017 is almost negligible. They're almost identical.
In other words, have got no material difference.
That's correct.
Did it frustrate you?
A little bit, yes.
What did it make you to think of the law enforcement agents with regard to this matter?
I think I would have expected, even if my suspicions were incorrect, at least the opportunity to present the position.
What?
This is, I merely had suspicions when I made the application, certainly not any accusations, but I think it would have been incumbent, or I would have expected at least to have some clarity from me, from the various authorities.
How did this thought aggravate with the recent email and the new investigator?
As I said previously, I remain here to assist the authorities in whichever capacity I can. To the extent that my suspicions are unfounded, I would sleep well at night. To the suspicion, to the event that they are, you know, that's really for the...
As a South African citizen, not just as a business rescue, which is your profession.
Yes, so
I move from a point that you are a South African and the future of your children is in this country. Here is an affidavit of July 2017, no material difference with of May 2017, no material difference in July 2017, recently an email and a new investigator. I'm talking to you as a South African. How does this make you feel?
I would prefer to have slightly more efficient services.
You're welcome. Honorable Zeli, fan.
Morning, Mr. Mazda. The meeting of the 11th of April, 2016, that you said approved the 586 million. Did you have any interest of knowing who those representatives of Eskom were part of that meeting?
I would now, but I was unaware of it at the time, obviously. I was not, Honourable Member, I was not present of the meeting and I was not aware that the meeting was happening, so I could hardly have been expected to have an interest, I think.
The meeting of the 24th of November, which was followed by the other meeting in December, and you are saying it was chaired by ESCOM. I'm interested in knowing who was chairing that meeting from ESCOM.
The meeting of the 24th of November?
The one of December, I forgot the date. The one following the meeting of the 24th of November.
The 24th was chaired by Machela Koko. And I'm not sure of the other meeting. If you give me the date, I could. The 24th of the 11th. 2015.
Yeah, you spoke about the one of the 24th, and you said the December meeting. I don't remember the date. That's the one that I was talking about. Yeah, you just said the December meeting.
I'm not sure which meeting you refer to. We signed the agreement in December, but there would not have been a meeting for that. The specific meeting that I think you're referring to is the one on the 24th of November, at which point ESCOM declared that they need to keep the good with the bad, and that was chaired by Machela.
Okay. I want to go back to the Tembani issue that Honorable Nguvelo was...
Tembani?
Yeah, that Mr. Nguvelo was talking about. How do you know that their proposal has been rejected?
They let us know sometime in October that they would not be able to fulfill the transaction, and that was done informally, and they withdrew from it. At the meeting on the 8th of April the following year, which was the meeting to approve the plan, Pembani was a minority shareholder in Optimum. They gave me a letter, effectively in a one-liner, detailing the fact that they were not given a similar opportunity, and effectively, you know, mentioning their displeasure at the process.
The 600 million shortfall. The 600 and, yeah, million shortfall, you were requested to go back to the banks by Mr. Ho to raise this particular aspect. And I'm trying to look at paragraph 17, where you were requested to inform Mr. Ho that the bank cannot release the 600 million. Why was Mr. Howard not part of that meeting?
I think that the bank consortium wanted to engage with me as the business rescue practitioner. I think that they would not have wanted the potential purchaser in the room, and certainly they caucused both with me and without me at that meeting as well. So I was effectively acting as the practitioner, and in my capacity scheduled the meeting at the request of the purchaser.
So that's standard practice, that a person who needs money is not supposed to be there.
I'm not sure it's standard practice post the conditions being met to renegotiate an agreement.
Your letter, the one that you directed to the anti-corruption desk, paragraph 10, the conditions, I'm interested in knowing the conditions that you are talking about. What were those conditions?
Those were the conditions in the agreement that we just went through with the Honourable Member in terms of the bank consent, the competitions approval, the consent of the DMR, and the consent of ESCOM to the transaction, as well as the adoption of the business rescue plan. So those were the suspensive conditions that were required to be met before a deal could be finalised.
I think the very last one, Honorable Chair. No, I think I raised this one earlier. I was talking about the ESCOM representatives who were part of the meeting that approved the prepayment of 586 million. I think I raised that one earlier. Okay, no, thanks.
You're welcome. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Marsden. Just a number of issues. The meeting on the 11th of April, obviously you wouldn't have been at that board meeting when it, but that was the concern that you set out in your letter to the Hawks, that prepayment didn't come to where it should have come. But that meeting, in terms of the public protector's report, which you have had sight of, those board members would have known that the prepayment was actually to buy shares and not for any pre-production requirement for OCM, which would have been the normal business practice. And that was a finding of the public protector in all probabilities. Would you tend to agree with that, although you don't have personal knowledge, but that given the fact that those board members were fully involved with the background of OCM, with the financial implications, and now suddenly they've been asked to approve a prepayment for pre-production mining, which is the normal thing, but whilst they know that it's actually not that, it is in fact to buy the shares. And that is the reason why you also filed that complaint with the Hawks.
Once again, I have no knowledge of that meeting. I'm not even sure who was present or attended. I don't know if it's a board or a subcommittee. So I certainly don't know what knowledge they would have had around the transaction, when it was closing, what was due and payable. I'd love to help, I just don't have any knowledge.
I do understand that. But obviously you've been very involved in this whole process. You're negotiating with the boards. You know what is in their knowledge. You know. And so I'm not asking you to speculate, but to me it's very clear that they would have known at that stage, and that is a finding of the public protector. But let's just leave it at that. What I also want to pick up, and this is, you see, you've also got to think outside of purely being a business rescue practitioner, of what is in the public domain at that time as well. When you come in, you're looking at the whole history of Optimum Mines, you're looking at Glencore, and now we know subsequently that there have been, whilst you were also the business rescue practitioner, you were appointed in August of 2015, and in September of 2015, well, in August of 2015, you might not have known it there, but Mr. Molefe and Mr. Ngubane are alleged to have met with the then minister, Mr. Ramatlodi, to suspend all Glencore's mining licenses. A massive, again, the implication for me is that there is pressure from Eskom against Glencore. That he refuses to do. The minister is then fired. And a new minister is put into position, a new minister that we now know is more Gupta-aligned. And in the time that you, the business rescue, which you would now have knowledge, you might not have had knowledge of Mr. Minister Ramatlodi, but in September, the new mines minister applied Section 54 stoppages at all the Glencore mines, including Optimum, which is the one under business rescue. So you should have been aware of that, and was it a concern of yours? Why is this additional political pressure now on Optimum Mind from outside? Please.
Thank you very much. Once again, I can't comment around Glencore Mines, but certainly within the Optimum Coal Mine, we did receive a stoppage notice. It wasn't a 54, I think it was a 92, right at the start of the business rescue process. So literally within 2 or 3 days of being appointed, that stoppage related to a technical infringement, and we were able to get the stoppage uplifted within a couple of days. Certainly heard all the stories around pressure being exerted on Glencore. Once again, not within my personal knowledge, unable to comment on it.
And we also know that Tegeta started to get involved, and they were doing small mining activities, Brakfontein, and those mining activities increased, and there was a problem with their quality. Would have that been any bearing with your involvement with Tegeta, their history with Eskom as well, and the fact that some of their stockpiles were rejected? Did you have knowledge of those Tegeta mines prior to this whole engagement? Let me just be more specific. Whilst you were a business rescue practitioner, you're approached by Tegeta, you know that Tegeta is already involved with Eskom and other mines, and there have been problems with those mines. Was that an issue?
Certainly came into our consideration. I think that we took really a couple of things out of it. First of all, I think Optimum had an excellent management team in place and would operate under our control, so they certainly would not have any ability to influence that. The second aspect was important to us in terms of they were an existing Eskom customer, and we thought that as a result of that, Eskom would have knowledge of them, so to the extent we brought a transaction, they would at least be an approved vendor, if I can use that terminology.
So we are aware that there's political involvement. We're also aware in terms of the Public Protector's report of Mr. Malefe meeting with the Guptas. Now, that might not have been in your knowledge at that stage, but was it not strange to you why the negotiations on the coal service agreement that seemed to be proceeding well, and when Mr. Malefa comes in, it suddenly stopped? And there's suddenly this acrimonious attitude with a company that's had a long-term contract of 25 years, and then suddenly you, as in business rescue, did you not find this strange in your... And again, tying up with pressure that we know the Public Protector has said that the conduct of the Eskom board was solely to benefit of Tegeta in awarding contracts to them.
So I certainly think we walked into a pretty difficult hornet's nest in terms of the relationships. Obviously, no commentary around the prior engagement and knowledge. But certainly it became quite apparent to us and quite clear that a transaction that involved a simple reshuffling of the contract with Glencore as a shareholder was unlikely to meet approval of Eskom. I think that the hard stance that the executive of Eskom took at the point was at the time something that certainly could stand up to commercial muster. I mean, somebody pushing back against Glencore is unusual. Somebody insisting on enforcing in a contract that in the short term would have been to the benefit of Eskom to get coal at the short term supply. The maneuvering of Eskom to have the good and the bad part of the business included in the transaction made commercial rationale to us. Somebody was playing hardball, and I don't think that there's an issue with that. In fact, I think it probably had some commercial sense to it. I think where the picture starts to get a little bit more murky is post the facts that have come out post the event.
If I understand you correctly, that the negotiations were done and there was commercial sense to that, but why would it then be necessary to have a meeting in Switzerland with the Minister of Mining? You obviously don't have knowledge about that. Mining, the Guptas, and Glencore, to almost put a minister acting in that capacity, which is unheard of. If it was commercially sound, why would that be necessary at all?
So I think it had some commercial sense from Eskom's point of view is kind of why I dictated those items. Correct, I don't know what happened in Switzerland. I certainly know that an offer that was capable of being concluded arrived relatively shortly after that meeting. I'm not sure what a minister's portfolio is meant to be. It does appear to be unusual, but I don't have a lot of knowledge of that particular meeting.
Well, it's again political interference in this issue, which is very clear. Can I just ask you, what I'm trying to understand is, you've got OCM is in dire straits. There's a penalty added, which actually puts them straight into business rescue, the $2.1 billion. But had that negotiation taken place on the hardship agreement continued, and had that penalty been settled, and then we now subsequently know that the loss-making contract was for the supply of Hendrina, and we now know that the Hendrina power station was reduced, and in fact, the OCM coal sold to Tegeta went to Arno at a radically increased price. Had you had that option, surely, even prior to Business Rescue, there would have been no reason for Business Rescue at all.
I think that option was tabled prior to Business Rescue, in terms of effectively switching some of the export product to the supplier to Arnott. Once again, I think we were looking for any options from Eskom, and in the first 60 days, as I detailed at the start, we made a number of different proposals to Eskom in terms of the continued supply of product to Hendrina. And once again, going to the prepayment issue, the coal that was supplied via Tegeta to Arnott came from the Optimum coal mine. So certainly that would have been an option that was available, but we were not able to conclude any of those.
But that is what is happening at the moment, as we now know subsequently. So that is how the Tegeta stroke Oak Bay stroke Gupta's have managed to change a loss-making mine into a profitable mine by moving the coal, which was what you proposed at the beginning, which wasn't accepted. So it seems it's very clear why the public protector came out with her damning findings that Eskom did not act in the best interests in terms of various provisions of the Public Finance Management Act as a public company as well. And we know the cost of coal has in fact escalated significantly. So, Chair, I just wanted to point out one other thing, and that is the Pembani deal. That contract is referred to in the Public Protector's report as well, and there was an issue there that during the negotiations, according to the Public Protector, it related to the consideration of the penalty and the consideration of the coal supply agreement. Exactly the same terms that Tegeta got to look at that, but I think the distinction that you make is that they were only looking at the one element and not the whole total. So it seems very clear to me that this whole deal was structured both from a political perspective and from an Eskom perspective to make sure that Tegeta received the benefit and received the mines at the end of the day, and then as soon as they got the mines, to then make sure that OCM was a profit-making company. Would you be in agreement with that?
I think that's the conclusion that the Public Protector came to.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
You're most welcome. Honorable Dlamini,
thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Mazdi, I just want to get the dates correctly. The You're saying you received a term sheet, or you signed a term sheet with Pembani, right? That is the first company that you engaged with. Is that correct?
That's correct, I'm not very well.
Okay, fine. And then when did you start speaking to Tegeta?
So they had approached the company prior to Business Rescue. They approached us prior to us accepting the Pembani transaction, and then we really started to engage with them once the Pembani deal had fallen over.
So the formal engagement, it was only when Pembani deal came, and then it said it's not going.
We'd had a variety of other interactions with them. We'd provided, we'd obviously signed non-disclosure agreements, as well as provided high-level information on the asset. I think I remember a site visit done in September where they built the mine. But in terms of actually moving towards closing a transaction and formal engagements, you're correct, that only happened once the Pembani deal had fallen over.
Is that the norm, that I come to you and then we make an offer and then we sign a term sheet, and then on the other side you are doing site visits with the someone wants to make a counter offer on what I'm doing?
It's certainly not normal, and once we signed the term sheet, there was an exclusivity in that. So the second we signed the term sheet until the term sheet failed, there would have been no interaction between the parties.
So how did you, why did you do the site visits and all these other informal engagements with the Tegeta?
It was a question of timing. So the site visit was prior to the signing of the term sheet. So there would have been engagement with a number of parties prior to it. We would have selected the bidder that made the most sense to us. At that point in time, we would have, and it was included in the agreement exclusivity, so we would have stopped all of the discussions until such time as that term sheet ultimately failed.
Okay, you mentioned the there was a shortfall of 600 million, and then you're saying you were made aware either through the Cataplank program that Eskom paid 585 to Tegeta, and the reason for that, I think you said through the interview, if I got you correctly, the reason for that was that they wanted to recapitalize the operations, improve the cash flows as well as operations. Is that correct? Where did you get this information so that I can capture it correctly?
So you're quite correct. The reasons that Mr. Howard gave in his interview with Carte Blanche was exactly as you stated, that the company was in business rescue and needed cash quicker. And the second item being the mine had a number of drag lines, large equipment that is used in the mining process, that needed to be recommissioned. They were on site, they didn't have to buy them, but they needed to be recommissioned in order to increase the production such that they could supply in terms of the agreement, or such that we could supply together in terms of the agreement. But the amount of cash required for that is in the region of about 10 million rand. It wasn't more than that.
Right. Then that's what happened on the interview by Mr. Howard. When did you hand over this mine, the full operation? You're saying in 31st August, which year, this year?
Of last year, 2016.
Right. In terms of your knowledge, did that mine come through to do exactly what the interview was, or the owner of the mine saying, we requested 585 from Eskom so that we can come and recapitalize the mine? Did that money come there while you were still involved in the operation?
The money definitely did not come to the mine in the period that I was until the 31st of August.
And did you report that to the authorities? Is it part of your...
When we became aware that a prepayment had been made, we reviewed the bank statements, and obviously that money had not flowed directly to the mine. We had supplied, as the mine, coal to Tegeta, and we had obviously received certain payments from Tegeta for the supply of mine. But that is on a 30-day account based on deliveries. The prepayment amount, as that, certainly did not come to the mine.
So, Nazimo, on that record that you got from Cataplank was lying?
It would seem so.
And that is included on your statement to the Hawks?
That's correct.
Okay. Lastly, you're saying the 585 was paid to Tegeta, and then it's the Bank of Baroda that wrote to the other banks to say we've got the money was paid on the agreed date before the cut-off date of the deal by the Bank of Baroda. The 2.1 billion.
So just you're correct, but I just want to break it down into a couple of items. So we had received a letter of comfort from the Bank of Baroda that Tegeta had sufficient funds in order to discharge the 2.15. So that's correct. We then, on the closing date, so the 11th came, they said they were short, we said no, or the bank said no. The money then arrived on, I think, the 14th or the 15th. That money was paid into the escrow accounts, and the money did flow from, I think, a Bank of Baroda account. They use a NetBank platform, but it did flow, and the purchase price was discharged in full. We only became aware of the source of those funds when all of this stuff came to the fore, and that's why we made the submission.
Finally, what is Nazim Howard's role in the company? What is his role on this Tegeta Holdings now?
So he was our principal point of contact throughout the discussions. I stand under correction, but I believe he was the chief executive officer of Oak Bay Holdings.
Okay, thank you. That was my last question.
Honorable Khawula.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, we know the view of the public protector regarding the refusal of Telkom to work with Pembani, of Eskom to work with Pembani. And we have our own view, which are very clear, that is because of Pembani was not linked to the Guptas, and they needed to structure a deal specifically that will prefer the Guptas, which in the main are together. Now, we want to hear your own view as a business rescue practitioner. I mean, you were there from the beginning of the contract. You had an interest to make sure that you are able to carry out your job as business rescue practitioners. What were your experiences in relation to Pembani and how they were executing their own duties before we interrogate the actual view of Eskom of refusing to work with them? What was your own experience? Tell us.
So I think we had relatively limited engagement with Pembani. I think they were known to the company being a minority shareholder. I think that they are a very well-known organization. And certainly the term sheet that was signed would have resolved the business rescue of OCM. We were not involved for very long with them because relatively quickly, within, I would say, less than a month, they pulled out of the transaction. They didn't give us detailed reasons at that point in time. We only received a letter from them, and that was in October of 15. We only received a letter from them on the 8th of April 16 as to the specifics for their withdrawal. So we did not have intimate knowledge of their discussions with Eskom. We knew what the preconditions were in terms of what was a deal that was acceptable to both us and to Eskom. And I really can't comment on how those discussions went between themselves and Eskom. All I know is that our deal fell away, and I was only informed of the rationale for that when we'd concluded the next deal.
Just follow up on it. Okay, fine. You may not have been involved, but when you started working with them, what was your own assessment in terms of their own capacity to do the work? Did you ever had reservations or qualms in terms of their own capacity to carry out the work as Pembani in terms of the contract?
No, they're a very well-known organization, financially stable, deep experience in the mining industry. I had no concerns around their ability to conclude a transaction.
And indeed, they had no links with Guptas, the Pembani.
That I'm aware of.
Okay. Let's pass it. I think it's paragraph 9 of the affidavit here. It refers to the purchase price, which is $215 billion. I want to check the payment process of that amount. What was an envisage way? Was it supposed to be paid in staggered ways as per the purchase? Or in terms of the contract, it would have been expected once off? Or just talk us through what was supposed to be the approach of payment.
Thank you. I think it's laid out in detail in the agreement, but I'll give it to you in a short version. When all the suspensive conditions had been met, so that's the DMR, Competition Commission, proof of funding, etc., effectively, they had 3 days to deliver the full purchase price. So it was certainly not intended to be obscured. It was not intended to be deferred. It was very, very clear that the full purchase price needed to be delivered within 3 working days of that final condition being met.
And you have already mentioned, I won't ask you about the substantive condition, substantive conditions that you referred to, but did they have any bearing to the price?
No, the price was agreed up front.
Okay, that's fine. Now, in terms of the prepayment, my interest was the prepayment laid out in the contract, or was it a practice? Was it something that was expected, or it was a new development in terms of the contract? Was it something that was there in the contract that a prepayment is one of the components of the contract?
The prepayment is not mentioned anywhere in the agreements. We had no knowledge of it until it became public information. We signed a variety, a number of different coal supply agreements, and when I say we, as in representing Optimum Coal Mine, we supplied agreements with Tegesa for the supply of product. They then had an agreement, I would presume, with Eskom. So I would not have had sight of that second step. I would only have, within my knowledge, the coal agreement that was between Optimum Coal Mine and Tegeta. Embedded in that agreement, there was certainly no prepayment. In fact, the payment terms were for the months January to April, middle of April, based on effectively COD. And thereafter, once the transaction had concluded, we gave 30 days from statement terms to Tegeta for the supply of that product.
And tell me, was this the first payment as it was expected from Tegeta? Was it the first payment, or was it the second payment?
The purchase price?
No, the payment that you said to be 586, was it supposed to be the first payment, or was it going to be the second payment? Was there a payment before it?
Once again, I cannot talk to the agreements that Tegeta had with Eskom. Prior to that, we had indeed supplied Tegeta from Optimum Coal Mine, and they had paid us for that product. I don't know what their payment terms were with Eskom, but there certainly was an agreement with them and Eskom prior to that prepayment.
Now, paragraph 13 says you were approached by Mr. Owa, that approached you as business rescue practitioners, that you must go and approach the banks due to the shortfall. Now, I want to know, because you'll school me, you were the business rescue practitioners of OCM that was expecting the payment. Why would you be expected to be the ones that make the loan from the banks to make up for the shortfall, when it is OCM that is expecting the payment?
I think a very good question. I didn't explain the relationship with the banks which would explain that. So you're quite right. OCH was the recipient of the funds. So in other words, OCH disposed of its shares and interest in the underlying subsidiaries. But the banks had security over the assets of the company. So the funds were paid into escrow, held on behalf of the company, but then the company had to pay those funds to the bank in order to discharge their obligations. It's a bit like selling your house with a home loan. Unfortunately, the bank, you know, gets the first dibs.
Okay. Now you decided to write to the authorities you have written to because you had your suspicions of corruption. Now, can you tell us in detail what were your suspicions? And in terms of the role players in the whole episode, what were your own views which you suspected that there's foul play? Give us names of those people and their own interest. What exactly was your suspicion?
So I think, as detailed in the report, there's really an issue that was suspicious to us was the timing of, and we had knowledge of the fact that the company or Tegeta purported to be 600 million rand short, and in the evening of that very same day, a very similar amount is advanced as a prepayment. So it's really around the quantum, i.e. they said they were short 600, 586 million rand was paid, and the timing of the transaction. So those were the items that arose our suspicion. In terms of a conclusion that we draw from that, I do not have sufficient access to internal Eskom rationale. When was the meeting called? Who attended it? What was discussed? What was on the agenda? I'm literally unqualified to make that call. Hence, I said, it is worthy of investigation and handed to the investigative body that is meant to follow up on those questions that I can't answer.
Now, will it be a reasonable suspicion from us seated here that Mr. Owa, as an executive of Tegeta, who claims to have paid the 586 million to OCM, which OCM claims to have not received, would we be justified to have that, to say that our suspicion is that him and his fellows in Tegeta have embezzled the money? Will you be justified?
I think what would be justified is an investigation.
Okay, lastly, my point. Now that OCM has not received their money, and you are business rescue practitioners, and I want to believe that you are charging a fee, and I want to believe that your interest is that you have not been paid. Is that the case?
So we were being paid, but we were being paid 30 days on delivery based on actual tonnage that was delivered. So effectively from post-closing on the 14th or 15th of April, we were supplying coal to Tegeta and we were providing them 30-day terms. In addition to that, the company was still supplying Eskom to Hendrina. So the company did have cash flow, so yes, I was paid in terms of that as well.
So how much are you owed now?
I'm not owed anything.
Okay, thanks, Chair. I was establishing the interest.
All right.
I'm happy to address the issue of fees. From a practitioner, you are tariffed in terms of the act based on the size of the company. It's an hourly-based rate.
Thank you,
Jeff. Honorable Luyeng.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Maldin, for the presentation that you have made. And maybe the responses that you have given already by now have actually lessened my questions. There is a hypothetical view generally in the
Honorable
country.
Honorable Luyeng, it's Mr. Maldin.
Mr. Maldin.
Abakafiki
ngaphangakuthe.
Abakafiki
Don't
ask me to say the honorable member's name, so I have to come let it slide.
So, a similar problem. Okay. No, thanks, Chair. Thanks, Chair. Now I'm well learned, better learned than yesterday. There is a hypothetical view generally in the country that there is a looting of state resources, in particular in the state-owned enterprises, and Eskom is part of that. And for us at this level, we require enough and sufficient evidence that will prove that this hypothesis is really a fact. And in us executing that particular duty, we want people like yourselves who are bold enough with enough and sufficient evidence to assist us and assist the process of unearthing corrupt practices in the SOEs. Over and above the information that you have said, would you be able, maybe at a later stage, as and when it happens that this process is taken to another level and there is proof, there is more evidence needed, will you be prepared to assist that process, or would you have such documentation or further information even over and above documentation?
I'm absolutely a South African citizen, and I think that there is a desperate need to colour in all of the aspects of this particular issue. I think, as I stated before, there certainly is, in my view, sufficient documentary evidence to warrant further investigation, and I would avail myself to the best of my abilities and to the full extent of information in my possession in that process.
Great. KPMG, as an organization, it's an old organization with at least it's a well-known organization. Was it for the first time that you come across them or you work with them this time in as far as this is concerned?
No, I've worked with KPMG previously.
Is it normal that when they interact with you, they declare as to whom they represent?
Generally, yes.
In this case, did they declare themselves as representatives of the Guptas or Mr. Duduzane Zuma?
At the initial meeting, they wished, and this is prior to Business Rescue, from my understanding of the documents, they were acting on behalf of a non-disclosed entity. In all of my engagements with them, we knew and they had disclosed who they were representing.
Did they declare or you had information that they represent those individuals? Did they officially declare that we are representing the Guptas?
I'm not sure if I received a formal correspondence in that regard, but certainly they would have arrived at meetings with the representatives on them, so it wasn't a big jump.
I don't think I'm satisfied in that kind of a response, because I want something that says, we are this company and we are representing so-and-so. Did they say that to you?
I will have to check my documentation.
Okay.
It's likely that we will have something, okay, in terms of which we were engaging with them on a number of different issues. So certainly we would have some documentary evidence that they were representing Oak Bay.
Fine. The prepayment, 586 million. I mean, it's unusual. But we'll get used to these figures. No, Jefferson, I've never seen this. I don't think I see. In fact, I don't think I want this amount of money.
Now you know how I feel when I saw the 50 million.
But. Jefferson, what I want to establish here, if there are instances that huge amounts of monies can be prepaid in this country, and you are not sure as to whether that was done in good faith. Anyway, can I check, did this payment actually happened on an application? Was there anyone who applied for a prepayment on the basis of 1234, or was it just a part and parcel of a generosity that was coming from elsewhere?
Once again, no knowledge of the prepayment or the lead-up or the build-up to how it was given effect to.
After having smelled a rat, because you seem to have actually, in the process, you smelled a rat, and then you took some steps and approached certain law enforcement agencies, did you get cooperation from them, or did they actually follow the information that you were providing them, or they only took what you said and recorded it, and then they never came back to you?
So they've largely got the information or the affidavit that I submitted originally. I have had an interview with a warrant officer. I signed the second affidavit, which is in a format very similar to the first. I've not been asked to provide additional documentations or have further follow-up interviews. Aside from the one that I received 2 days ago.
Okay. So are you happy with that? Because my own understanding is that when you wake up at your home, you approach them, you want to be heard, and you would want action to be taken. If not taken, you are informed as to why an action will not be taken.
I think, as mentioned previously, I certainly would have liked a degree of urgency around issues to the extent that my suspicions were then invalid. Great, the issues resolved. To the extent that there were not, I would have liked to see more significant progress made. I think we also had a lengthy discussion with the public protector around this issue as well. So, you know, we've tried as best as possible to ensure that our understanding is as complete as possible, and I'm sure it will develop with forums like this and hopefully others that develop.
So maybe lastly, Chair, who is the most legitimate source that you think at the thickness of things you would say, now this is the rod I'm going to use, a legitimate one that would be regarded as being a prima facie kind of an evidence that will come. Then, if us as Parliament we do nothing about that, then you will cry foul.
I think this forum is certainly constituted to try and get as much as possible. Not that I'm a lawyer and understand, but certainly you have the ability to request documents and subpoena people, and I think that this would certainly add to the knowledge already in the public domain in terms of trying to get some traction on, as I said, trying to colour in the missing pieces of the puzzle. And certainly forums like this would have the credibility in terms of trying to find the smoking gun, if I kind of trying to understand what it is that you're looking for. And I think only by comprehensively setting out the time and the context from a variety of different forums will ultimately the questions be answered.
Now, maybe how long had Glencore do business with Eskom?
Other than very long, I'm not sure. And I'm sure they continue to do business in their other operations. But certainly they are a very big supplier to Eskom in their other operations. And my understanding is they continue to do business with Eskom.
So there is no smelling of a rat around them also?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Rest my case, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mare.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two clarity questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Marsden. Questions of clarity. One important date in this whole saga is the date of the 11th April 2016, when there was a meeting that evening in Eskom as well. To your general knowledge, on whose watch, who was the CEO of Eskom at that point in time?
I believe it was Mr. Malefi.
And do you know who was the CEO at that, or CFO at that point in time?
I believe it was Mr. Anuj Singh, but I'm sure you could verify that.
No, just checking. That's why I'm asking your general knowledge. At that point in time, do you know who was the chairman of the Eskom board at that point in time?
I think it was Dr. Ngubane.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay. Yes?
Mr. PG. Honorable PG.
No, thank you, Chair. Thanks for baptizing me differently. Perhaps the first point, Mr. Marsden, is just a comment. So if you want to add to it, you're welcome. But you've been quite helpful to reinforce what is already out there, as you correctly point out, in the Public Protector Report, in the various documents that are now in the public domain. So if we take Mr. Marais' point, Mr. Swart's point, Mr. Kaula's point, I think, as well, and put them together, it's fair for this committee to actually come to a fairly strong hypothesis that there's a direct link between the appointment of Mr. Molefe as CEO, the appointment of Mr. Anuj Singh as acting or real CFO, the presence of Dr. Ngubane as the chairperson of the board, the meeting with the former minister, Ramaklodi, the subsequent appointment of Mr. Zwane, the visit to Switzerland, the opportunity that this Oak Bay, or rather Optimum Saga presented, when there might have been a lapse on in the quality, and that's the part you can comment on. And then you get all of these transactions concocted in order to seize this opportunity to transfer a mining operation from one set of owners to another set of owners. So I think it's helpful for the public to know that those are dots that are connectable, and that the evidence leader should bring on more witnesses that would help to connect more of the lines that then completes this hypothesis and confirms it in some way. So that's the first point. The second is, if you can help me to understand, the Bank of Baroda says we've got 2.15 to pay over for the transaction. Am I right?
That's correct.
Right. But just prior to that, 585 was the missing amount out of the 2.15.
So there's a slight timing difference. The right. Bank of Baroda letter is issued in March, so the 4th of March 2016. The discussion around the 600 million rand shortfall is on the 11th of April, so a month and a bit afterwards.
So and when was the 2.15 paid over?
It was payable, I think, on the 14th of April.
And is it your assumption that the 585 was necessary to make up the 215?
It's the conclusion that the Public Protector came to in her report.
That it was a contribution to
absolutely.
That. But you then said that that amount, that money went into the Tegeta account, but not the Optimum account.
So it went into the, if I follow the Public Protector's analysis, it was paid to Tegeta, and then Tegeta effectively paid that into the escrow account, or an aggregate amount, for the discharge of the purchase price.
So to put it in simple terms, the 585 was used to make up the 215.
It appears.
2.15.
Absolutely appears that way.
Okay. And that then brings us to Mr. Swart's point about whether you're buying shares or you're buying future production, because the then CEO made a big case of that publicly, that this is about buying future production. This is actually buying a company, stock shares in the company. Is that correct?
Correct. At the time of the payment, it wasn't even the owner of the mine. It simply had the right to acquire the mine.
Then, just to shift to a different focus. So here's a mine that is contributing or selling coal to the Hendrina power station. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are we right? I think several of our colleagues have raised the point that this coal from this mine is now being sold to the Arnott power station.
That's correct.
And whereas, let's say, the coal was being sold at X rands to Hendrina, It is now being sold at X plus rand to Anat.
Correct.
Do you have the amounts? Approximately.
I 2X or 3X is maybe better than X plus, but yeah. Slightly different qualities of coal. So, I mean, it's not completely like for like in that the power stations each have a unique coal specification, but essentially it's the same product.
Because it's from the same mine.
It's from the same mine. It's just washed and treated slightly differently to upgrade the coal to a certain degree for Arnott.
Who benefits from this?
So the mine, Optimum Coal Mine, effectively benefited from the ability to sell product, round numbers, 500 rand per ton to Tegeta, who then onsold it to Arnott, as opposed to supplying for 150 round numbers to Hendrina.
So effectively the new owners benefit from the additional amount?
Correct.
And does that necessarily, is that the amount that was required to make Optimum financially viable? Or is this beyond that amount?
It really depends on the mix and the volumes, but certainly it would contribute towards making it financially sustainable if you were able to sell product at a higher price.
No, sustainable or super profitable?
I think the context of Optimum would always be sustainable. The issue really arises in terms of the good and bad side of the business. So if you're looking at a net purchase price, it takes the profit on this side of the business and the negative of this side of the business. If you're able to remove the negative, I think the profit arises not necessarily in that legal entity, but in the overall picture.
No, but I think you were hinting earlier on that what was originally the profitable side of the business, i.e. Kroonfontein, if I got the pronunciation right, and the terminal at Richards Bay, those are now being disposed of.
It's been in the press, whether it's been concluded or not, I've got no knowledge.
Okay, so we can get the evidence leader to bring us, the evidence will tell us. But if that is being disposed of, the question of balancing profitability doesn't come into the equation.
Correct.
The standalone mine is now profitable. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in that business.
Correct.
And you wouldn't have done your job of rescuing the business.
Correct.
Okay. I mean, well, this last point, from cost of coal to quality of coal, what's changed during this whole period? You know, this whole saga started because the quality was poor, and that was the public discourse about the supply of Optimum coal to Eskom. And Optimum is still under a different set of owners supplying the coal. What's changed?
So a number of things could have changed. Clearly, I've got no knowledge beyond August 2016.
Right, up to 2016.
But a couple of items could have changed. I think that there was an issue in the methodology around how the coal was sampled, which was effectively giving an error on product. It is essentially the same coal, but you could wash and or screen to beneficiate the coal to get it back within standard specifications. It would obviously reduce your yield, but certainly there would be technical methodologies that could be used to take the same product coming off the same seam to upgrade it to a different product. But once again, that's hypothetical.
Okay, thank you.
Honorable Shivambo.
So thank you, Chairperson. I want to raise again the concern I raised yesterday that we're dealing with crime that is taking place now. It's not ended. Perhaps we might need to take certain decisions in terms of what should happen. I don't want to ask questions. I just want to make some quick observations in terms of what has happened. That so Tegeta is owned by Oak Bay and Mabengela Investment, which is like almost 100% owned by Dudizanezu. And then they want to buy Optimum Coal Holdings from Glencore, which is broadly a company with even Lisenberg in Switzerland based there. Then the first approach, Ngoko Ramatlodi, who's the Minister of Mineral Resources that time, to say that utilize the legislative instruments to push Optimum Coal Holdings out of business or into a risky situation. And then Ngoko Ramatlodi says no. And there is an undisputed newspaper report that when Ngoko Ramatlodi went to see President, Mr. Jacob Zuma, he met Duduzane Zuma sitting with Msebenzi Zwane outside there in the same meeting. And Zwane is a person who gave the Estina dairy farm to the Guptas in the Free State in Friede to do business which was illegal there. Zwane is the person who has signed a letter inviting the Guptas, which ultimately led to the Waterkloof landing of the airplane there. Few months later, he gets appointed as a Minister of Mineral Resources. And his first stop is in Switzerland to talk with Glencore about the whole Optimum Coal Holdings, which they then syndicate a fund to buy it. They use part of their money. They take money from Trillion. Like yesterday's evidence, and even the Badlander evidence, illustrates that they took 160 million rands from the Baroda account, which Trillion had, with Salim Issa is involved, and Eric Wood, and all of those people. And then when there was a shortfall of 585 million, whatever amount, then they go to Eskom to say, we're asking for prepayment, and then that group of Brian Molefe, Anot Singh, Ben Ngubane, Matela Kuku approved that prepayment to complete the syndicate fund to purchase Tegeta mine. And then increase the allocations of the tons that Tegeta can supply to Eskom on a monthly basis so that they can make maximum profits and with ease. And when all of that is brought to the public discourse and is being exposed now, they sell together to themselves, to a shelf company somewhere in Dubai, and they continue to supply coal to Eskom. They continue to supply coal to Eskom through a deal that is patently illegal. Through a deal that is decidedly illegal, like through an illegal cobbling up of a deal that there's prima facie evidence that it's illegal. And when we raise this, when you go to the police, when you go to the NPA, they say, no, we're going to work on it, we're working on it. The Hawks, no, we're working on it, we're investigating it in the broader context. Let's wait for commission of inquiry. But this is illegality that is ongoing now. Tegeta is still recipient of millions of rands of payments from Eskom as we speak, which is directly benefiting the same people who claim to have disposed of it. They have not disposed of it. They have just put it in a different form. What do we do? I think that is the question that we should respond to. If the SABC inquiry report is anything to go by in terms of the local standard, the legal standing, we perhaps should make some immediate resolutions and check if Parliament can't take some immediate resolution to halt some of the ongoing crime that is being committed now. And if they subject us to judicial review, it's fine. We'll go to court as Parliament to defend that. We had to do something because all the other institutions which otherwise were supposed to stop the crime, which is ongoing now, are not doing anything. And what are the implications of all of these things? The implications is on ordinary people who are now going to be forced to pay 20% more for electricity because of the mismanagement of Eskom. Because Eskom is asking for 20% increase on tariffs. And that has got a direct impact even on what ultimately could be a recovery of the economy. There's a shortfall of more than 50 billion in terms of what is required for the state to operate optimally. and you are increasing electricity under those circumstances, we have to do something. I don't think that our hands are completely tied. We should look into tabling a preliminary report, make concrete recommendations, and if whoever is affected thinks that we've acted outside of the law, they must subject us to judicial review, and then we'll then take it from there. I'm more than convinced that a rational court of law will appreciate that Parliament has been able to act in a rational way to stop the corruption that is ongoing, the industrial looting scale that is ongoing in South Africa currently, because we can ask questions and we must not delay this thing. We're going to collapse South Africa, we're going to collapse the entire fiscus in our watch without having done anything. And when history looks back and say, what did you do? We'll say we're just talking amongst ourselves and asking each other questions when the crime was ongoing. I think we have got an opportunity to do something, and let's discuss how do we table a preliminary report. Wishfully, next week, Chairperson, in the next sitting of the National Assembly, in the next ordinary sitting, we must table some of the preliminary report in terms of our observations, and we take concrete resolutions of certain things must be stopped so that we are able to stabilize the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Shivambo. Honorable Nobanda.
Thank you, Chair. I only have one. Mr. Marsden, what's your understanding between the cost plus mine concept and the prepayment arrangement? Thank you.
I think that's a very good question and often misinterpreted. Optimum is not a cost-plus mine. It has a long-term supply agreement signed, I think, in 1993. So I think the concept of a cost-plus mine and a prepayment are quite linked. But Optimum is not a cost-plus mine. It has to deliver a fixed price of coal escalated on a bunch of metrics.
Pardon me?
So prepayments... In my understanding, have generally been used in the context of cost-plus mines. My understanding, I'm not an expert on Eskom's procedures, but from what I read, that is a term that is generally associated with a cost-plus mine, where Eskom is required to fund development and production. Optimum is an established mine on a different type of contract. Beyond that, it's not really in my domain.
My question, Honourable Natasha.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I just want to get something straight, because yesterday, when the evidence was given to us yesterday, the name of Mark Pomanski came up continuously. Now, Mark Pomanski was on the board of directors of Eskom, and he's also on the board of directors of Oak Bay, and he also was a partner at a company called Blue Label. Now, someone that used to be a partner at Matheson, Gary Kaplan, was also a partner at Blue Label. Now, I've just checked on your letterhead that you've given to Parliament, and I see that Gary Kaplan is no longer a partner at Matheson and Associates. So I did a little bit of research on my phone, and I saw that Gary actually resigned when the Gupta emails were leaked. Is there any chance that, given the fact that someone in Matheson is so connected to someone at Oak Bay and someone at Eskom, that there's any connection in terms of the purchasing of Tegeta? Because it's a little bit fishy the way it's coincidental that he was on your letterhead and then he wasn't. So I'm confused and I'm concerned at the same time.
Sure, I'm happy to answer that. It's not nearly as dramatic as that. We employed Gary's son in our organization, and we thought it was inappropriate to have his son employed. He was a non-executive director of our company. He's a lifelong friend of Les Madison. And Blue Label was, I think he resigned from Blue Label maybe 15, 20 years ago. So it is an unusual circumstance, but it's not as dramatic as you suggest.
Thank you. no other person that wants to do a follow-up question, I am closing the meeting now. Oh, Honorable PG?
To make you hungry first, you see. Thank you, Chair. Can you help me clarify, whether you interrogated the quantum of the fine, and if you found it to be legit, meaning that it had some rational mathematical basis for it. Is it possible that the fine should have been 70 million versus 2.1 million? Secondly, how did that fine disappear eventually? I don't think any one of us has quite interrogated that. And there's an interesting relationship between the quantum of the fine and the quantum of the sale amount, because they're both about 2.1. Three questions.
So with regards to... I've lost the first question again, sorry, Honourable Member.
The quantum of the fine, and it's whether...
Did we interrogate the fine? Sorry about that. Yes, we certainly did. We spent quite a lot of time investigating it, and we prepared a very extensive report around it. It had a variety of different categories in terms of the claim. Certainly some of it would have been arguable that the fine should have been levied. There was coal that was our specification. Some of it would have been argued the other way, that it wasn't. In terms of the settlement, that happened post the 31st of December, so 31st of August. So once again, judging on the press reports around the settlement, I think Mr. Vernara may have mentioned, did somebody mention 600 million rand? I'm not sure if that's the number that's been agreed or not. That's not a publicly available document. But it could have been in that quantum. But it would be very hard to assess. It would have been down to technical analysis, down to evidence of experts in the matter. Then with regards to the last point on the similarities between the purchase price, the purchase price was actually a bit more than the 2.15. That was the contribution that had to be made by Oak Bay. Glencore also contributed a percentage of the purchase price in order to meet certain other obligations. So the purchase price is about 2.6. So I think that's purely a coincidence.
Mr. Marston, do you think that these monies that have been, that were played within the entities of public enterprises, do you think we will ever be able to get them back? How? What is your suggestion? How can we get those monies back? Because they belong to the community of South Africa. They belong to the poor people.
I certainly hope so. I think that, going to the Honourable Member's suggestion, I think urgency and timing are always critical in these items. And the chances in most situations of ultimately recovering from parties, if they have done wrong, decreases over time. So the sooner that action is taken, I think the better the prospects of success are.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Honourable Members, for your questions. Thank you, Mr. Madden, on availing yourself. And thank you for the information you gave us. We know that you gave us an information that is out there, but you took a decision of coming to the inquiry and binding yourself with the information and what you know as a person who was partly involved. To us as this committee, we have gained a lot out of what you have given us, as much as we had time to read some of the things that you have talked to. But coming from a person who was part of it, it's giving us much more a clear picture of what was happening. We really appreciate your time, and we hope that After this, you will live your normal life. You will not get involved in things that are unlawful, you know what are the consequences of getting involved in unlawful things. You are here now. I know that in your entire life, and when you were setting up your business, you never thought that you will ever come to a committee of parliament and come and give evidence in the committee of parliament. But you did that because you never know what tomorrow holds for you. Thank you very much, and we appreciate really your coming to this committee. And the committee, the inquiry and the committee is adjourned. Can the members, the multi-party caucus, stay a bit, and so that we go through some few things?
Oh.